Accession number 10165, reel number 42.
Martin McLean, reel 42. You were telling me about the course of events during the retreat down the Mayu Peninsula, if you'd like to continue.
We found out the reason for this constant withdrawal was the Japanese were pushing along the Mayu Peninsula, along the top of it, and they were pushing for a tunnel in Butidong, and we were in a position where we could be easily encircled again, and the powers that be decided we had to withdraw. That's all there was to it. We moved further back this time to another group of high hills, very high hills, and again on the seafront, again the front unit of the defensive positions. And this time I met up with some really book-trained soldiers, Sikhs, young soldiers. We had to relieve them because they weren't battle experienced. They'd been rushed up from India. They were in the throes of training and had put them across this line of defence under such a time as they could be relieved by more experienced troops, and that was us. And we went up to these high hills and took over these positions, and it was just like we used to do in peacetime. The young kids were standing there with their rifles and bayonets on and laid out in the front of them on the parapet of the trenches they dug, because Indians are very good at digging. They had their reserve ammunition laid out, neatly polished, neatly oiled, their grenades, the spare grenades and everything laid out as per copybook, you know. In other words, the section come in, there's my reserve ammunition, there's my grenades, I know just what I want, and then he puts them out underneath. All these little positions, these lads, smart as button sticks, in their KD, by the way, and the Tobies, no steel helmets, turbans, all along as it went along, these positions were. I met their sergeant major, I forget the name, I think it's a Havildar, and he handed over the reserve ammunition to us, which he had carted about six boxes of ammunition. We took over these positions, and we overlooked down into deep valleys and away down foul points. A beautiful place, you know, like a Swiss Family Robinson sort of area. Beautiful sea to sea, the sand, the greenery, really a nice place for a holiday, a bungalow or a picnic. And here we were at war, that made no difference. We were in these positions, and I had to go back to headquarters for some reason. And I was amazed. There was a full officers' mess having dinner together. All the Sikhs in their peacetime peacetime mannerisms, had a great big marquee built in full sight of where the Jap guns and the spotters could see, at least in my opinion they were. And there they were all coming in from their different company locations for their dinner. And there was the CO line in the blue, I was going to say bloody big armchair. The CO line in a big armchair. And we were looking in amazement. We were all scruffy, dirty. No tents. We'd never seen tent for ages. Our COs and officers just the same. Our officers were exactly the same as us. They mucked in with us. And we're all in the same boat sort of style. And there was these people in lap of luxury having plates and proper served meals for them. They had to have a wash before they had the meals. I didn't see it all happen, but the men that were behind it, like, were telling me about it. You want to see them. They're going like they were in peacetime camp. Anyway, they moved out, these young Indians. But I was impressed by them. They'd been well taught, and they handed over to us very efficiently. We hadn't been on top of these hills long.
One thing, you mentioned that your officers mucked in. They had pretty much the same lifestyle as you did then. Did they have any advantages as officers in the...
An officer had no advantage whatever. If there was advantages, they wouldn't accept them. That's the type of officer we had in the arms.
Had that changed since 1939, 40?
Oh, tremendously so, yes. Yes, there was a distinct difference between officers and men, yes. The officers dressed different. They would be standoffish. They wouldn't be mucking in. But now, your officer was part of the men. He dressed the same as the men. He carried a rifle the same as the men. Why? I explained before, because we learned that Japs look for people with pistols and a man with rifles is just an infantryman. And they were just one of us, dirty and scruffy. Not intentionally that way. It was just we couldn't get a wash. We couldn't get a change of clothing.
Did that?
We were rotten with smell, must have been.
Did you have to? Was there informality? More informality than with them living amongst you, and looking like you? Did it lead to more informality between you?
No, they were always sir, and they were always to me sergeant major, and to the men sergeants. Always the correct mode of address, but as I say, they were with us more in spirit and in body than they had ever previously been.
Did that help morale, or did it help the efficiency?
It helped tremendous. The men then found that the officers were just as same as them, maybe a bit frightened, maybe, well, they were scruffy dirty, the same as us, or just one of us. But they accept them as the commanders, the officers. There's no query about that at all. My company commander, I thought the world of him, Roger Stock. He was scruffy dirty.
He was the replacement for the chap wounded on the Sugarloaf.
That's right. He was the second in command of the company, who I explained once before. When we were up in the reserve position, they had the second in command, Roger Stock, and the company commander, Major Hutton, together with the company. And we met Jack Hawkins, the actor. Well, just after that happened, all second-in-commands of company were told to report back to battalion headquarters. And they were kept there in case the company commanders were knocked out. Maybe through our company commander getting knocked out, I don't know. But they were there as a reserve company commander. So now Roger was commanding the company. Him and I used to sit and chat. And many a time when we're sitting doing nothing, waiting for things to happen.
What would you, when you were with the Stocks a lot, I know you always used the formal terms of address, but did you get to know him as a man, or was it a formal relationship as well as formal address?
It was a formal relationship. You didn't inquire after his family. You'd want to know about your family, how was the wife and things like that, but then again you didn't probe into their background, because maybe part of my back train, the bringing up I'd had, you don't inquire into officers' background unless they tell you. And I've still got that way of life now. I don't probe into anybody's way of life unless they offer information. On the top of this hill, you could see for miles and miles. And then we got the order we're going to move once again. And this was a thing that really stuck in my craw. And there's no explanation for it. It's just something I wanted to do. Mind, at the same time, I must tell you that I was suffering terrible depressions now, because I'd lost three men. I'd had this effort in Dunkirk. I'd had this effort in Donbake with the on the Sugar Fire positions. And I'd lost so many men, I was getting down, low down myself. Maybe lack of food, maybe time for rest or whatever it was, but I was getting a bit depressed. But the company commander moved off with the signalers, and I had to see that everybody was clear of the hill. Now, in other words, I was the last man away from the hill. All the platoons marched past. And then I see that everything was, nothing left, ammunition, guns, anything of that nature. And as the men were, the company commander moved off with the sets, I looked over and there's a full battalion of ruddy Japanese walking down from the hill, walking down in front of us, about 200 yards away. And we hadn't a Bren gun, nor a wireless to call for the artillery fire, nor the 3-inch mortar fire. It was one of the dreamed of targets that a man thinks of all his life. There was a huge number of Japanese coming down in their jungle green, following the leader. They were coming down the hill, making straight for the sea. They were making a straight line between us and anything further down there. So anything that was down there would have obviously been cut off, but everything was out of there. So if we'd stayed in that other position any longer, would have all been encircled once again. And I could no way bring any fire to bear on these men. And it grieved me. It stuck in a craw, but just one of these things had happened. And the Japanese had a jungle green outfit, but they were so discernible. It wasn't a camouflage, really. It seemed an odd type of camouflage for the area they were in. You could see them. You could see them distinctly.
It was a different shade of green.
Shade of green. With some, maybe, I'd say, I never got close enough to them. Maybe they'd been washed out or worn out or whatever it was, but there was patches of khaki showing in it. But you could see these Japanese walking down there and clattering down this hillside, and we couldn't do anything about it. We moved out of this position and moved further back once again. And back and back and back. Now there's a lot of debate going on about the 2nd Division, who had been seconded from as an independent brigade, consisting of the DLI, the Royal Berks, the Royal Welsh, and the Royal Scots. the division wanted us back. Because this argument is still going on with India, they didn't want the British troops to be responsible for our division. Later on, as we moved back to one of these positions, we were told they were going to be withdrawn and getting out of it. And now they'd found more Indian battalions to relieve us. Under the Indian brigades, a brigade of Indians consisted of maybe two Indian battalions and one British battalion, like the Lincolns, like the Lancashire Fusiliers and different things like that. There was always one British battalion with a brigade of Indians. So they were finding more troops for to replace us, and we were taken out. Mind, I'll say at this stage, we needed a rest. I'll just explain my situation. I was getting strung up and tight, and I'd bark at anybody, or shout at anybody, or give them a rollicking for nothing, well, for something, but in a maybe harsher tone than I should have done. But we were getting in a worse, and everyone was getting in that state. We needed a rest. And, of course, we wanted some good food inside of us. We moved back to a place further back, and there was some bamboo bashes there. It was on the road out to Chittagong once again. I don't know how far back. And we got into this basha area, and our CQMS, and in other words, the Q branch was there. And you know, they give us the food there. They give us some white bread, two slices of white bread, and some tea and food. It was like being at a big banquet, just to have the white bread and things. We lived on starvation rations for a long time, and this bread was something we hadn't had for an awful long time. Another little thing which I'd like to remark upon, which really shook me to the core, I went back to our company headquarters, the stores. I don't know the reason for me going back there. It'd be something military, because I never left the company lines unless I was on some duty bound. I had to do something, maybe weapons or do something of that nature. And I saw some men standing outside what pretended to be our Q stores. And there was the storeman going through all the dead men's kits. And I blew me top at this, because that is not the job of a storeman. He was taking all the good stuff out and flinging the khaki away, the KD and stuff. We'd lost all our heavy baggage, by the way. We'd lost a lot of our baggage, but we still maintained some of it at this company HQ. And he was throwing the men's stuff away, which I thought was wrong. And so I went in, I got a hold of the colour sergeant, which is the CQMS. I laced him good and proper, I took him aside and gave him a good dressing down about this. Lack of interest in the men's own personal private properties, which should be dealt with by an officer, and gone through by officers and returned to the people's units, the people's homes if they wanted to. And I got a hold of the storeman and I stuck him under close arrest, because he's a bit insubordinate about it, because they'd done no fighting. They'd been among the food, among all the good stuff in life, the rum and everything. But they were getting the best of these lads' kit, which they should never have touched. Now, that was lack of control somewhere along the line, I'd say through the Q branch. Any man that was killed, his personal effects should be gone through by officers and returned to the man's family if there were any sentimental value, or destroyed, not allowed to be given away piecemeal to Tom, Dick and Harry. Don't forget, when we go into battle, we don't take all our good kits. We leave some kit back at base. Once we get near a battle zone, we leave other stuff in small packs or wrap-ups and with bedroll and things of that nature. And then we take our large packs forward, which contains a blanket and different things. And in there, you might have some small stuff. Now, the Japs had got all the packs with all the stuff in. Incidentally, I lost two gold rings in that. I didn't mention in passing that when we came back from Indin area, out of Indin, I was asked if I'd go forward with a patrol of men and a couple of carriers, track vehicles, into where the packs were to see if I could find the battalion's typewriters. So I went forward with this patrol of men. I went walking with the men, and the carriers followed, intending to carry the typewriters. And there was all the battalion's packs stacked neat and smart. But there was no indication what was what, because I'd been in mind to find a gold ring that was my wife's grandmother's. She'd given us Why the blazer didn't give it to the wife, I don't know, but I think she said, no, you take that, that's yours. I didn't want a gold ring, but it was a beautiful gold ring. Anyway, I lost it, along with everything else. And we never got the typewriters. Somebody had been there before us and smashed them up. So we came out of there without getting the battalion's typewriters, because a valuable piece of machinery for to run the battalion.
Did you think the CQMS, the Q department in your company or in the battalion, did as well as they could have done? Because you sound a little bitter about it. Do you think they could have made greater efforts to get food forward? Do you think they could have controlled things a bit better? Or do you think that was just part of the conditions that they were facing, that they were going to fail anyway, however they tried?
Well, I'll be honest with you. After Dunkirk, and I told you about the CQMS was going away from when I filled them in, I said, I want a section of men. I had no time for CQMSs. They looked after number one all the way along. I can't ever remember the CQMS ever coming up with the mules to our forward positions. Now, I know that other CQMSs came up with their men. Now, another great thing which remains unanswered. How was it that when we done the attack on the Sugar 4 and 5, that my company was the only one who never received its rum ration? Now, it means that he was lack of interest. Now, if I'd been a CQMS, feed me men, unless I was directly ordered to stay behind, I would have been up feeding the men. I would have carried my duties out 100%.
So it was your company's CQMS that you have a grudge with. The other CQMSs from the other companies seem to have done a better job.
Some did, some didn't. But you see, we were so scattered. We had little contact with other companies, what was happening. I'm talking about my company, CQMS. We had many a row, but he was an old Indian sergeant, and he became CQMS. And a man with vast experience, a very old soldier. But I still feel that he could have done better in his job as CQMS than he did. And this thing rankled me about the going through the kits. I had him before the company commander, of course, but the damage had been done, and the company commander, like everything else, just told him off about it and forgot the thing, but I didn't. I never forgot it.
So you were going back to rest now?
We were going back to rest, yes. Now, we then got the information that we were going back to join the 2nd Division back in Ahmanagar. We went through the same procedure of crossing the Bay of Bengal in a troop ship into Calcutta, where we boarded troop trains and a 6-day journey back to Ahmanagar. Ahmanagar, we thought we'd done a good battle. We had fought the Japs, you could say that, without much witness of having seen a lot of dead Japs. You know, you have the picture of you mowed them down like a row of wheat. You never done that with a Jap. You hardly saw them. Bar these few that we saw, this company we saw travelling across the front, we had a good shoot there. When we got back to the battalion, or the unit lines, we found that once we got settled there, the men started going down like flies with malaria and different things of that nature. I went down 2 or 3 times with food poison, just to state the stomach. A really bad bout of food poison, having to go to the local hospitals for to be treated in just a few days and back out again. And that was my main worst affected thing, apart from malaria, that I had while I was in India. Food poison. I used to get it. If anyone showed me a tin, I think I got food poison from the tin. Other thoughts of it. That was diarrhea and vomit and sickness. And you used to vomit so much, you used to dehydrate your body. And you used to be in a state of collapse.
And that, you reckon it was from the tins, not from the fruit or the water?
I think it was from the tins. No, not water used to give dysentery. I think it was from the tin stuff that we're getting. At one time, during the feeding, I'd like to remark on this, we started getting some American supplies in. I don't know where they came from, but this is just prior to the battle of Sugar 4 and 5, were being fed before we went up, and they gave us spinach. I'd never had spinach before, tins of spinach. And we'd had no greens for a long time, you know. We were living on the hard tackle. Without the Indian Army just didn't supply the greens for the British troops. Curry for the Indians and what have you. They weren't geared up for it. But we got these tins of spinach, and it was nice. I used to like it. It was like green moss. But nevertheless, it done the body good. Another thing we got while we were there was tins of cooked bacon. I'd never seen that before. Mind, that was only the rare occasions we're back in the line, back out the lines, maybe when we're getting our ammunition changed and things like that. We're well fed back there, but once we're up the front, we're back on dog's rations again, the dog biscuits.
So what else were you doing besides being ill at Armenaga?
We got settled down straight away to reforming, re-equipping, reclothing the men. Everybody now had to change all this dirty, stinking clothing we had. Medical inspections, checks, inoculations, and the usual things that we'd lapsed while we're up there going on again. In other words, it's about a good week of rest, changing clothing, and getting inoculated, being medically inspected, being seen to in general. In other words, getting you fit and cleaned up to look like soldiers once again. Getting the men more established in their platoons and their companies, getting them into barrack rooms, teaching the new lads the ways of the barrack rooms, getting them interested in sports, drill competitions, drill exercises, guard competitions. All these things start taking place once again, not so much to keep the men interested, but to really get them involved in being part of a company. And the men took to the sports and the hockey and the basketball and all these sort of things. Great. It was wonderful to get a bit running around. Now, just short while afterwards, the men, we found that the men were having a lot of sores, running sores on their knees, on their elbows, where maybe they fell playing sports. And they wouldn't heal up. You know, like a bare red raw wound, and they just wouldn't heal up. And the medical officer couldn't contend with it, and so they sent for skin specialists. And you might laugh at this, but they found that going through the history of the camp that we were in, it was called Stud Farm, and it was a place where they raised camels for the India years ago, and they were quite common. They had syphilis, and the ground was infected by the syphilis from the camels, and it was still alive in the ground. It wasn't the same syphilis as you get with VD, as the troops would have. It was a skin disease that was causing skin disease. So the answer was, all the men, officers as well, had to sit out in the sun and show their wounds in the sun about an hour a day. And you'd see all the great line of blokes, me included, sitting with our arms or our legs exposed to the sun to dry these syphilitic wounds up. And the lads used to shout, "Get away, you syphilitic bastards." We eventually got out on training once again. And the other battalions who had not taken part in the...
You'd not had that problem before, though, when you were at Armenaga, had you?
No.
Was it that your bodies were just generally run down then?
I should say so, yes.
And you're a bit more vulnerable to infection.
Yes. They started giving us treatment for malaria as well, malarial tablets, which we started getting little tablets to take for malaria. Now, the battalion was, as I said, was going down a lot with malaria because Armenaga was a warm place. And that brings malaria out. We're getting it in such a bad way that the battalion was really going down with it. Started their own malarial wards in the lines. So if you took malaria, just went over there and they were kept in for about a fortnight. And the men came out weak and shaken and just joined their companies again. But coming back to the division itself, these people who hadn't taken part in the Arakan campaign, that was another 8 battalions of different county regiments. Whenever they saw us marching past, "Yeah, you windy buggers, yeah, shower, couldn't fight the Japs, you couldn't beat the Japs," nearly caused fights on the march, passing. But when they went up the front, they were no different to us. They were exactly the same. We couldn't beat them because we were buried so much in the ground. And we got really angry with these people who were always calling us and shouting at us. When they played football against us, our lads used to kick them off the field just to get their own back and them few players.
Was there off-duty trouble between the battalions?
No, we were so well segregated in brigade areas that, well, how can I say it? We were so well segregated that we didn't come in contact with each other very much, bar on big exercises or marching past, on a long march, things of that nature. And so you had very little trouble. Truthfully speaking, there was no point in going out. There was a weeny little, dirty little village called Amanaga, away up with a railway track running alongside it. There's a few little shops which sold rubbish. There's nothing of interest there at all. There was a cinema there, by the way, and there was some of the old garrison buildings where there was a theatre, where the officers used to go to different shows of, you know, operatic things and what have you, put on by the local people. We wouldn't go to them. And the only time I went to Amanaga was to see a film show.
You wouldn't go, or you weren't allowed to go?
We were allowed to go, but we didn't want to go. There was not. You had better life in your own little bunk, sitting there writing letters home, going to sergeant's mess, having a little drink of gin or something, because beer was very short.
What was the sergeant's mess like that when you established it?
Well, we were in old peacetime barracks, but they were made for Indian units, not for British units. And we had a proper established sergeant's mess. And it was a nice place, a stone-built building, mud-built, I'd say, more than stone, with its doors and its windows in, and its oil lamps. That's all I could say. It was clean, it was whitewashed and clean, and that's all I could say about that place, Amanaga. It was a good training area. You had bamboo bashes for the men, and then you had oceans and oceans of space around you, flat scrubland. Away on the left you could see the rifle ranges, where we used to go over there and zero rifles and do some shooting to get the men's rifles back to the zeroing capacity for their own eyes and what have you. And from there on just became, once again, individual training, company training, battalion training, divisional training.
Was there any different, from your experiences in the jungle, did you have any special exercises, or were you doing new things from what you'd learned?
No, they used to have conferences and a lot of our information was gleaned. Now, there's a thing that I could never understand, even up to today. I was a person who had been up the front at Sugar 5, 4 and 5, and seen the whole of the area. I ran around the whole lot, as I explained in my detail. I've run around looking for some men to go into the attack on the position. I knew every inch of that area, and yet no one asked me my opinions of any hazards that were likely to impede any future attacks on the troops. And then they launched the Royal Scots in the same positions, over the same obstacles. And I could have told them if they could have made some rough-hewn ladders, just so they could carry into this steep riverbed before the Japanese positions, just in front of the Japanese positions, so the men could get up these ladders and over the top, whereas we couldn't get up with all our heavy goods, and this side was so steep, like the height of this. And you're just stuck at the bottom of this thing. They just slung grenades in you, whereas they had ladders, and they'd got into the ditch and straight over the top. They'd been into the Sugar 4 and 5 instead of coming in the long way round. No one asked me my views of it. No one asked me about the ammunitions that wouldn't fire, the guns wouldn't fire. No, everybody seemed as if they wanted to forget it.
So there was no debriefing about the whole affair?
Nothing at all, as far as I was concerned.
About the whole campaign? Either.
Nothing about the campaign, but we used to discuss in our own way for second div rights, pros and cons. As a matter of fact, second div set up its own battle school with the commanding officer of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers as command, with experienced WOs and sergeants who'd been up the front as instructors. They wouldn't let me go, by the way.
Why not?
Well, the company commander said I was more important with the company than being sent off to a small arms as a small arms instructor. As a matter of fact, him and I had a chat. I didn't want to leave the battalion.
Did you ever go to the battle school?
Yes, I went to battle school.
In that period?
In that period, yes. And we learned some very valuable things there. We went through the same rigmarole of being up the front and the Japanese shouting to you, "Hey, Johnny, help me. Like, that's what the Indians used to shout with our wounded. "Help me, wounded," you know, and cries of wounded, trying to encourage you to go forward, and they pinch you as a prisoner or something like that. And then they'd take us on all sorts of little bits of schemes they devised that had happened in the jungle. And they'd also take us on firing every gun, every weapon the infantry had. Now, there are guns there that the men never had a look at, the 3-inch mortars. 25-pounder artillery guns. They showed us how to fire them. They put and the howitzers, by the way. And they put them on the trail. The trail is the round piece that they put on the ground and they put the wheels on, so it forms like an anti-tank gun. They can swivel it round to point in any direction to engage tanks. Well, I learned an awful lot from that little school.